welcome back to the second hour now of Shattering Myths, where we're going to focus on Yah's testimony. So you'll come to know God in accordance with his teaching. Again, I'm going to spend just a moment longer in the with something that we were considering in the last segment, because for many, just as that email that I read at the beginning of the show, for many, it's really helpful to first come to know who God isn't and how religion corrupts. Once you do that, your mental slate is cleaned, and it makes it a lot easier to recognize who God is. So first let me make one final statement on Afghanistan and as it relates to those who aided and abetted America being slaughtered once America leaves. That all is because America did not heed the lesson of Vietnam. Because Americans were unable to grapple with what happened in Vietnam, how we made a bad situation worse in Vietnam, and the moment we left, more people were slaughtered because we did not learn the lesson of Vietnam, and George W. Bush decided to invade Afghanistan. It is all our fault. We chose to ignore the lessons of history, and this is the consequence. People are going to die in ever greater numbers. As for the five sources that comprise Prophet of Doom, the source material appendix of the book, it goes into great detail to explain all of the sources of the Quran and how they came to us, including the Quran itself, so that you understand the origins of Tabati, of Ishaq, of Bukhari, and of Islam, Muslim, that in each of these sources, when they were written, by who they were compiled, of which they are comprised, and how they are arranged, whether it is chronological or topical. But here's the reality. The Quran has in it a verse called 2106. It's the abrogation verse. It's one of the most famous verses in the Quran. It says, whenever a verse do we abrogate, do we change or cause to be forgotten, we bring a better one. Know you not that Allah is able to do all things? What that says is that the Quran is so full of contradictions that it has a way to deal with contradictions. And so the way the Quran deals with contradictions is that the verse that wasn't really very good, Allah brings a better verse. One that in many cases, in fact in all cases, contradicts the previous one. And so the only way as a Muslim you can know whether you are to treat Christians as if they were akin to Muslims, or slaughter them, as the fifth surah says, crucify them, cut off arms and legs on opposite sides and torture them, as the fifth surah says, or treat them as, oh, their comrades, is which of those contradictory statements was revealed later? Was the Quran's there should be no compulsion in religion true, or the statement in the fourth surah which says if a Muslim rejects Islam, kill him, which I would consider to be compulsion? Which of those is true? Because they're directly contradictory. Well, the Quran says the one that came last, more recently, is the one to follow. Well, the Quran is a jumbled mess. It has absolutely no chronology. And, you know, for example, the last surah revealed is the fifth. And yet it's the fifth, not the 124th. And the first surah revealed was the 96th, not the first. It's a jumbled mess. The only way to order the Quran chronologically is through Tabati. Because even though Ishaq compiled hadiths before Tabati, most of Ishaq has been lost. If it wasn't for Tabati, we wouldn't have much of Ishaq. Because Ishaq is quoted vociferously in Tabati. And therefore, Tabati and Ishaq are the foundation of Islam. Islam's five pillars cease to exist without Tabati and Ishaq. The Quran cannot be ordered chronologically without Tabati and Ishaq. Without Tabati and Ishaq, there is no Sharia law, because the Sharia law is based upon the hadith that they have regarding Muhammad's words and deeds. The Quran itself is hadith, because it was spoken by the same person and passed ear to mouth over the generations by exactly the same people who supplied us with the hadith. If the hadith is not true, the Quran is not true. There was something that that Nick wanted to discuss that Scott, my producer, said, you know, I'll discuss it with you, but we're not going back on the air. And I want to make certain that you know that my reluctance to discuss this has nothing to do with inability to expose it and do away with it by evidence. And so, since I have claimed that Muhammad was a pedophile, that when he was 53 he had sex with a 9-year-old girl, I would like to read the proof of that from Tabati. We're going to turn to book 9, page 131. This is Tabati, volume 9, page 131. My mother came to me while I was being swung on a swing between two branches, and she got me down. My nurse took me over, and she wiped my face with some water and started leading me. When I was at the door, she stopped so I could catch my breath. I was brought in while Muhammad was sitting on a bed in my house. My mother made me sit on his lap. The other men and women got up and they left. The Prophet consummated his marriage to me in my house when I was 9 years old. He was 53 at the time.
Just for the record, the definition of consummate is, in this sense, it's a verb, and it's to make a marriage or relationship complete by having sexual intercourse.
There you go. He was 53 years old at the time. She was 9 years old. That is perverted. That is textbook pedophilia. And Aisha, this girl, was not the only one. And she was probably the only one whose mother and father arranged for her to be abused and as a victim of pedophilia, where the mother and father had Muhammad come and sit on their bed and brought their daughter, after cleaning her up, and forced her daughter, their daughter, to sit on his lap so that he could molest her. She may be the only one who is a victim of not only Muhammad, but also her own parents. Abu Bakr was the one who did this. Abu Bakr is essential to Islam's formation, as is Muhammad. That was his daughter. But the hadith is filled with other stories of young girls, children, being added to Muhammad's harem. This is a repulsive man. And his religion, the more you know about it, the more offended you will be about it, the more you will come to hate it. If you do not hate Islam, it is for one of two reasons. Either you do not understand the religion, or you have no moral compulsion, no good judgment. You are rendered incapable of responding appropriately to things which are so vile. That, I think, is sufficient to close our news segment of today's program. And yesterday, as we were discussing whether or not, and this is a small matter, but it is an interesting matter, and just by pursuing this particular matter, whether it is Masiyah or Masiyak, yesterday I demonstrated conclusively that it is not Christ. Basis, no justification whatsoever for Christ. It is wrong in every possible way, and that it means drugged. And if you call yourself a Christian, you're saying that you are drugged. And that the actual word that the placeholders in the earliest manuscripts represented was Christus, which is a useful and valuable upright servant doing good work. And that is a perfect match for Masiyah, which is the implement doing the work of Yah. Well, we were going to just touch on the choice between Masiyak and Masiyah, recognizing that Masiyah is used as a name nearly 20 times in Scripture, and Masiyak is really never used as a title. And the only time the title is applied, if you want to even call it a title, that it is applied to the future Yahusha, there is no Ha Masiyak in front of it. And unfortunately, the one place where it is used in reference to him is in the book of Daniel. And unfortunately, even in the book of Daniel, While there are 8 partial manuscripts of Daniel, some are fairly significant manuscripts of Daniel, and much of the book is covered. And even though these copies were written, scribed between 125 CE and BCE and 50 CE, it should be noted that all 4 of the scrolls containing material from the first 8 chapters of the book were originally scribed in Babylonian Hebrew, but they switched to Aramaic in the chapter 2, around verse 4, reverted back to Hebrew at the beginning of the 8th chapter. It's the only book that was actually scribed in part using Aramaic. Now, none of the 8 scrolls found in the caves above Qumran provide witness to the text between Daniel 7:18 and 10:4. The reason I share that with you is the only place that it is assumed that HaMashiach, the anointed, is used as a title relative to the coming Messiah is in Daniel 9:25 and 9:26. They aren't extant in the Dead Sea Scrolls, so we are now reliant on the Masoretic, which the earliest extant document of the Masoretic is written in the 11th century of this era. And so those statements are right in the midst of the void. And even in the Masoretic, there is no ha, definite article before it, so it's not even being used as a title there. That means the oldest manuscript says testing to this minor difference, which is the length of the left leg on the concluding letter with major implications, Masiyah versus Masiyak, was written by rabbinical Masoretes in the 11th century. This manuscript, known as the Codex Leningradus, dated to 1008 CE and first published in 1937, makes it clear to those who recognize that the rabbis had an agenda, one affirmed by Maimonides in the 13 Principles of Judaism, which states that God is incorporeal, is on display to distance rabbinical Judaism and their version of the Messiah from Yahweh and the Messiah. So we'll return to this in a moment, moving on to other evidences on behalf of Messiah. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Hello, welcome back to Shattering Myths, where we are focused right now on shattering the myth that we should refer to the Yahusha by the title Christ, and by even the title HaMashiach, but instead as Messiah. And I'd like to finish that when we're done. We have a call from Michael, who is in Texas, and he wants to discuss how God has instructed us to communicate with him. The topic will be prayer, which I think you'll find fascinating if you're stay with us and listen through these next 2 segments. But let me finish the demonstrating that the evidence on behalf of Messiah being strong, it's used and recorded in the Qumran text some 20 times, and the evidence on behalf of Messiah is weak. It is not found in the Qumran scrolls ascribed to Yahusha. Another issue is that every scriptural name and title from Isaiah to Zechariah, which is Yashiyahu and Zechariahu, from Mount Moriah to Messiah, which is transliterated IAH today, is actually Yah in the revealed text. Just as Kumbaya and Hallelujah speak volumes for those with the ear for Yah's word today, so does the legacy of IAH at the end of so many names and titles, including Messiah. 5th, Messiah provides a perfect depiction of how Yahweh used Yahusha. As Messiah, he was Yah's implement doing the work of Yahweh. Messiah even serves as the perfect complement to Yahusha, whereby we are told salvation is from Yah. Yahusha means salvation is from Yah, and Maaseiyah is the work of Yah. Sixth, now that we know that the divine placeholders used in the Greek text represent the Maaseiyah, and that they were based on Christus, not Christos, we find a perfect match. Both words convey the same message. Yahusha is Yah's useful implement, his upright servant, who does good, moral, and beneficial work. And that is a whole lot better than being called Christ drugged. It is therefore reasonable for us to conclude that Yahweh assigned the title Maaseiyah to Yahusha. As has been our custom now, though, let's examine Maaseiyah through the lens of the ancient Hebrew script in which it was originally written. The first letter of Maaseiyah is a mem, used to be called a mah. It was conveyed by way of waves on a water. It symbolized the origin of life and of cleansing, as water is the universal solvent. Even today, ma in Hebrew means water. The second letter is an ain. This character, which is also found in Yahusha's name, was drawn to depict an eye. It's used to convey the ideas of sight, of observation, of knowledge, perspective, and understanding. The third letter in Maaseiyah is a sin, which was called a shamak, or is called a shamak today. Its graphic symbol was akin to a thorn, a hard, sharp object which was known to pierce. It came from a bush which served as a protective barrier from carnivores and ill-tempered men. It conveyed the ideas of cutting, of piercing, of separating, of dividing, in addition to shielding and protecting. The last two letters of Maaseiyah are mirrored at the beginning of Yahweh and Yahusha's names. As we know, the Yod was drawn to represent an outstretched arm with an open hand. It represents God reaching down to lift us up. It symbolized his power and authority to do whatever work was necessary. The final letter in Maaseiyah is a He, whose pictographic forms revealed a person reaching up and pointing to the heavens. It conveyed the importance of observing what God had to say and of reaching up to him. No one was better at this than Yahusha, Ha Maaseiyah. The picture painted by these historical characters collectively reveal that the Maaseiyah is the source of life and of spiritual cleansing for those who know and understand him, who observe his words and deeds from the proper perspective. While he was pierced for our sins, and while he came to bring division, he has the power to protect and to shield. As Yahusha's representative, the Maaseiyah comes with the power and authority of Yahweh. He is literally the hand of God doing the work of God. Those who recognize these things and who reach up and rely on him will find him ready and willing to assist. That is the message of the characters, of the jots and the tittles, that comprise Ha Maaseiyah. With that section of our foundation laid, after the break, we're going to turn our attention to Michael, who wants to learn more about how we are to converse with God, and specifically how that relates to the Christian notion of prayer. So, Michael, hang on. Right after the break, the long segment, we'll be back with you. This is Shattering Myths. Hello and welcome back to the Yada section, if you will, of Shattering Myths, where we expose and share the things of God, whose name is Yahweh. Throughout this last break, we've had Michael on hold. Thank you, Michael. I understand that you have some questions regarding communication with God, which the religious term for that is prayer. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I did have some questions on prayer. You had mentioned to a woman who'd called in some time ago about prayer not being mentioned in Torah. And yeah, I understand that. And I, looking back and just taking a cursory view of the Torah, I can see, well, there's people not really praying throughout the Torah. And then you were talking about Daniel just a moment ago, and I remember, well, what was Daniel doing? He was praying, and then of course there's communication mentioned throughout the the prophets.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I grew up, of course, in a Christian home with what I would refer to as a few templates of prayer, hearing my grandpa at the dinner table and, of course, hearing the Bible school teachers, preachers, what have you, with what just appears to be a template of prayer that I guess I'm trying to get away from now, having to unlearn the crap that's associated with Christianese, Christianity, and the like as I'm mm-hmm. learning the Torah. So my question is now, you didn't really elaborate after mm-hmm. stating that prayer's not really in the Torah. Could you elaborate a little bit on
sure.
What God's perspective of prayer is and mm-hmm. how I should approach communication with God? You also mentioned making arrangements with God. God asked you to mm-hmm. write, address the issues with Islam, with mm-hmm. Prophet Doom, and other material that you've written. And what exactly is our approach to God and when we communicate with Him? How do we address that? What is our approach?
Okay. Good questions. First, let's kind of jot some things down as you were talking, Michael. First, the statement of fact, prayer is not mentioned in the Torah. The foundation for understanding God, for coming to know Him, is the Torah. You cannot come to know God apart from the Torah. He is knowable through His Torah, and that is the full extent of where God is knowable. Yeah, He reveals through His prophets things that provide other insights into His nature and character, but the means to come to know God is presented in His Torah. The means to engage in a relationship with God is presented exclusively in His Torah. So the means to engage with Him exists exclusively in the Torah, and prayer is not mentioned relative to how to engage in a relationship with God. Conversation is shown. Give and take, questions and answers are shown throughout that formation of the covenant, but prayer is never mentioned. It isn't mentioned also in the whole plan of salvation as the Torah presents the historical basis and the mikra, which are invitations to be called out and to meet with God. The seven of them don't include an element of prayer. So from that, we can deduce for certain that prayer is not an essential element of us forming a relationship with God or of our salvation. That's just a statement of fact. Now, that does not mean that we should not communicate with God. You mentioned Daniel. In the book of Daniel, I'm doing a Sabbath show. I do it Friday evenings at Yada Yah Radio, where we're actually studying the book of Daniel. And in the first couple of programs for that show, we show Daniel conversing with God. But the way that he converses with God is the same way we find Dode, who we know as David, his real name is Dode, it means love, converse with God. And it's the same way that the Torah presents us conversing with God, which is to listen to Him first. Christians, religious people, have this tendency. They start by telling God whatever they're going to have in their template prayer. This is what I want. This is what I want to know. And they begin talking. God says, no. Want it the opposite way around. I want you to begin by listening. Listen to what I have to say. Observe what I have shared with you. And then respond to that. The most magnificent song ever written is the 119th Psalm. And it is devoted, all 176 verses, on how to observe the Torah so that you respond to it appropriately. And the whole thing is, listen to it, observe it, and based upon what you learn, come to understand it, and then respond appropriately. So if we were to change the religious term prayer to respond and engage in conversation after we have first listened, then you would have God's perspective on prayer. Now, Yosha, who Christians don't like to listen to, said, don't pray in public like the hypocrites. So when your dad would pray around the table in front of the family, Yosha said, don't do that. When there's public prayer in churches, Yosha said, don't do that. Don't be like the hypocrites who are doing that kind of stuff. If you want to talk to me in private. And then when you notice when he gave an exemplar conversation, he's addressing Yahweh, you know, our Father. That's his, the way that he wants to be known, who's in heaven. Set apart is your name. It's Yahweh. Your will be done. How do we know his will? It's only presented in one place. The Torah. It's the only place he presents his will. And so, once again, it's about listening and then responding. And so, God does want us to communicate with him. The whole formation of the covenant is filled with communication. Even in Daniel, when we see him communicating, it's after he has studied. He presents himself having studied the words of the Torah and the prophet. He specifically talks about the Torah and how he studied it. He's come to understand it. And based upon it, he's now recognized why his people are estranged from God and what needs to happen for that relationship to be reconciled. And based upon what he has learned and come to understand, he is now responding to what God has offered. So, throughout the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, conversation with God is encouraged, but he's a whole lot smarter than we are. What he's encouraging us to do is to listen to what he has to say before we respond. A great example of this, Michael, is that Christians are constantly asking God for his will in their lives. Well, God wrote his Torah so that we would know his will. When somebody says, I want to know your will for my life, and they haven't bothered to even read his Torah, which presents his will, that's an insult to him. It's why he says in his prophets that he does not hear the prayers, nor does he see the people who are not Torah observant. If you're not Torah observant, if you don't study his Torah, come to understand it, and respond to him based upon what he's offering, you're wasting your time with prayer. And I'm not speaking to you, Michael. I'm speaking to the audience out there, because I know that you've come to know Yah. But if you are asking God for his will and you have not read his Torah, he doesn't hear a word you're saying. Doesn't even know who you are. You're wasting your time. Start by listening to him. Go ahead.
How would you address all of the, every silly little thing from finding your car keys to finding your next job and everything in between that Christians have and that I've experienced myself in years past that
yes,
you have an issue, you
bring it to God,
spout some prayer and
sometimes
get a resolution that you attribute to, God answered my prayer.
Yeah. Right.
And,
you know, by the way, the Christian goes both ways.
By the way, that doesn't always happen.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not always a resolution.
Yeah, it's so funny that if they sense that they have a resolution, then it's they attribute it to God. And if they don't get a resolution, they say, well, that must be God's will. So no matter if they get a resolution or they don't get a resolution, it's always an affirmation of God's will. It's so silly. Listen, God is vitally interested in the lives of his children. But the lives of his children he views through the covenant. If you are asking God and studying his testimony relative to the covenant, he is going to, and you are looking in the right place for answers, he's going to answer every one of your questions. He is vitally interested in you embracing and growing in the covenant. He doesn't care where you work. He doesn't, your choice of what you're going to, how you're going to resolve the fact that you can't remember your combination for your bicycle, so somebody can scurry off to class or you forgot where your car keys are. He does not intervene in our lives in minutia. This idea that God is intervening in everything and that he answered the prayer and he decided to heal old Susie Q, but he decided not to heal Johnny is just absolutely inconsistent with God's testimony. He is not intervening in minuscule aspects of our daily lives. His agenda is the covenant. It's a big picture item. It's, are you interested in coming to know him as he is? Are you interested in engaging in a relationship with him as he has made this available. Are you willing to walk to him along the path that he has provided? If you are, all of those essential questions, he's going to answer for you. He's going to provide the guidance for you. He's going to reach down and grab your hand and lead you along the way. But when you ask him, where did I put my keys? It's not the subject that he's going to engage and say, oh boy, I can't wait to help out my kid by helping him find his keys so that he'll have an affirmation that I'm involved in his life. Doesn't do that. So I'm telling you that the Tim Tebows who thank God for their touchdown, God's repulsed by. It is, it's as if God takes sides in sporting events. And he just doesn't. He's not the God of minutia. He's the God of the covenant. It's a big picture item. Does that help, Michael?
You mentioned, that does. That helps a lot. It brings me to one one other question, though. You mm-hmm. mentioned about God intervening, and that's probably where I have the most confusion right now. What you've said about communicating with God, I is great. I loved hearing that, and I'm a lot more clear on what Yah is interested in hearing from me, as opposed to what I'm interested in babbling.
We only have about 15 seconds. Can you clarify your concerns over intervening?
What God's intervention is in our lives is okay. As far as
we're out of time, Michael. Yeah, we have 6 minutes in the last segment. I'll answer how God intervenes in our lives after the break. This is Shattering Myths. Thank you, Michael. The time continues to flow by all too fast. We're in the final segment of Shattering Myths for today. And the question that was asked by Michael, all of Michael's questions I thought were good ones, but his last question was, how then does God intervene in our lives since he's not interested? I shouldn't say he's not interested in the minutia of his children. He is not engaged usurping free will to micromanage the minutia of his children. God promises that he's going to intervene in our lives, specifically our lives, five different ways. Now, that's beyond the way that God intervened to pave the path from our troubled world to his home through his fulfillment of Pesach, Passover, Unleavened Bread, Bukkurim, and Shavua, moving all the way through the Day of Reconciliations and Shelters. That's all are examples of how he intervened globally in the lives of humankind. But individually, he promises five things as a result of the covenant. If you embrace the five terms and conditions of the covenant, God promises as your dad to intervene and provide the following five things to you. The first is he makes you immortal. You go from being mortal and therefore having a rendezvous with death to becoming immortal. That gift comes by way of Passover. The second thing he promises is to make you perfect. He says, walk to me and become perfect. The path to walk to him is over the threshold of unleavened bread, where we are unleavened of our sin. Our sin is removed. God perfects us so that we are perfect, eternal creatures. The third thing that he does for us is adopt us. The most important form of his personal intervention. He adopts us into his covenant family. We go from being children of our earthly parents to being children of God. Literally adopted into his family. Getting to live all eternity with him and becoming his child, his son or daughter, the moment we make that choice. The fourth thing that he does for us is to enrich us. He makes us vastly more powerful than we otherwise could be, but his primary means to enrich us is by way of his teaching. He teaches us and guides us to what we need to know to live the most productive lives absolutely possible, to be effective witnesses on his behalf so others come to know him and so that we enjoy our relationship with him as much as it is absolutely possible. And the better we know him, the more we know what the reasons that he's created this universe to facilitate the covenant, the more enriched our lives are. And he not only enriches us this way, as his kids, we inherit all that is his to give. He owns the universe. It's ours. And he empowers us. I think this is the most amazing of all of the blessings of the covenant. And you really have to dig into, and we don't have enough time in today's program, into the nature of matter versus light and how we are going to be empowered by going from being material beings stuck in the ordinary flow of time and as material physical beings actually being flawed and devolving in terms of our effectiveness and usefulness over time. We're going to be invigorated and empowered becoming spiritual beings, which is akin to energy, akin to light. So we'll no longer be stuck in time so that we will have the ability and power to do things just beyond our current grasp. We're going to go from being 3.5 dimensional individuals to operating in a realm of 7 dimensions. Those are the 5 ways that God has specifically said that he's going to intervene in your life. Now, one of those in particular, the enriching and empowering aspect, which is was brought to us by way of his intervention on Shavuot, on 7 Sabbaths, following Bukurim, when we were adopted into his family. He enlightens us and empowers us and enriches us so that we can effectively share what we have learned about his covenant and about him with others. So that God's family is enlarged because the message that God has revealed to us is known to more people. He enables us and empowers us to understand his testimony and to share it with others. Those are his gifts to us. Michael?
Yes, sir. I'm getting the impression that most of our concerns just from day to day are relatively inconsequential.
Yes, you are right.
What we've actually been and given and are receiving.
That is correct. They are. The gifts that he is giving us are eternal. They're magnificent. They're overwhelming. They're mind-blowing in terms of their value. And the things that we typically ask him for are so minimal, so de minimis, so insignificant when compared to the 5 gifts that he is willing to bless us with, that we ought to focus and enjoy his 5 wonderful gifts, the gifts and benefits of the covenant. We're out of time today. Michael, it was a great call. I hope you call us again. Thank you very much for leading us down this journey of how we listen to and then communicate with God and what we receive in return.
Hi, everyone. I'm Pharmacist Ben, nutritional pharmacist and host of The Bright Side. The good news about nutrition and health. The good news that if you or someone you care about is on a prescription drug or has some kind of health